famous lead balloon that I let go in Sunday school once, that he feels bad for not supporting me in my liberal ways as much then, but it was a great friendship, and I got to know his wife through Cub Scouts. We were serving Cub Scouts together, and it's been a great friendship, and it's been an honor as Sunstone editor to have someone like Tom Rogers. Dan, would you like to publish this? Yeah, you know, and involve him in things. And he's continually gracious when he gets something accepted or whatever. And I've occasionally, this wasn't right for Sunstone, that kind of thing. But anyway, Rick Jepson is someone that I hope to have you all get to know better. Rick is a registered nurse living in Provo, Utah, or working in Provo, living in Orem, right? And he just passed his boards, a major fun hurdle. He's working towards graduate study in neurology and mental health, and he's currently researching various mental defects related to stroke. You may know him as the author of our cover article of our November Sunstone, which is the one on God wrestling, and the Jacob and the Angel, one of the best and most thorough treatments of that story in a long time. We're also excited that Rick has agreed and sort of conceived, and we're working together on a new column called Bounds and Conditions, which debuted in the last issue, which is about the intersection of science and Mormonism. So Rick wrote a framing piece last time. This next issue will have another small framing one, kind of with the best quotes sort of outlining the way Mormons have historically dealt with science and religion conflicts. But then primarily it's a column that we want you to contribute to. And he and I will work together selecting those. So Rick's an energetic presence and a great friend who I'm so excited that he got excited about Sunstone. And I know you'll enjoy hearing from both these great men. Tom.
Why do I not remember to leave my jacket home when I come to Sunstone?
Two analogies occurred to me as I developed this paper. First, that of a dialectical assertion with its thesis, antithesis, and subsequent synthesis. The second analogy, more visual, that of a triptych with two opposing side panels and finally a central one attempting to integrate and reconcile the other two. Hence, the paper's three divisions. This paper is less an argument than a plea. Its persuasiveness is for you to judge, but it may also serve as a kind of litmus test, as when, during the Cold War, Solzhenitsyn's early short story One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich became available to the Soviet reader. With all the fierce conviction, however subjective, that particularly Russians can muster, people at various points on the ideological spectrum then began saying to each other, "Tell me what you think of Solzhenitsyn's story, and I will tell you who you are." Our dual challenge, ecumenism and abiding faith. I was recently struck by the following words: settle for nothing less than moral and spiritual greatness. Don't cheat yourself. Teasingly, I asked a fellow priesthood bearer if he knew which of the brethren was its source. He couldn't recall, but agreed that it was a fine utterance. Then I told him that its author was a Polish Catholic, Karol Wojtyla, the late John Paul II. My friend's immediate response was, "Yes, but he didn't have the authority." Not even the authority, I gather, to perceive and impart such universal wisdom. I fear that as a people, we are increasingly inclined to find valueless or even suspect any such insights and utterances that do not come from officially approved sources. And yet there are in our midst ample manifestations of seemingly acceptable, almost cultish extra LDS fads and notions the nadir of which may well be the recent enthusiastic discussions at BYU of that potboiler mystery novel which dallies with highly questionable historical and religious notions, the Da Vinci Code. Nor have J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis had much difficulty inundating our sensibilities. Treatises by the psychologist Scott Peck and the psychologist theologian John Sanford have in their time been equally popular items at the BYU bookstore. The Hebrew scholar Jacob Neusner and the precocious atheist literary scholar Harold Bloom have in turn been equally welcome to the Mormons, who know them because of the many fine things they say about us. Similarly, her arresting insights about temple traditions have even brought the British Methodist local preacher Margaret Barker to BYU as a forum speaker. President David O. McKay was extremely fond of another Scotsman, Thomas Carlyle, whom he often cited in his conference addresses. While scholars at BYU are presently involved with church encouragement and subsidy in producing unprecedented translations from Arabic of various esoteric theological texts, doubtless in large part and good as a goodwill gesture to the Muslim world. The definition of the best books has, especially in times past, been fairly wide-ranging, and why not? Doesn't that wonderful elastic clause, the 13th article of faith, imply that the sources of what is virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy are manifold and may crop up in various unexpected places? And what if those intriguing verses, in particularly 2 Nephi and Alma, "Know ye not that I bring forth my word unto the children of man, yea, even upon all the nations of the earth? And, for behold, the Lord doth grant unto all nations of their own nation and tongue to teach his word, yes, in wisdom, all that he seeth fit that they should have." The memorable First Presidency Declaration of February 1978, attesting to the inspiration and goodness in the many non-Christian world religions, quoting, "The great religious leaders of the world, such as Muhammad, Confucius, and the reformers, as well as philosophers, including Socrates, Plato, and others, received a portion of God's light," is in the Book of Mormon context simply a reiteration of that same ecumenical principle. Hence, Tancred I. King's 1983 observation in Dialogue, quote, "Christianity can gain from Islam a heightened awareness of the majesty, the grandeur, and the absoluteness of God. From Hinduism, Christianity can gain greater respect for mediation and reflectiveness. From Buddhism, Christians can understand the impersonal side of ultimate truth. The Confucian emphasis on humanism, social order, and filial piety can enhance Christian life. From Taoism and Shintoism, the Christian can more fully realize the sacredness of nature," and close quote. In like manner, the words of others in the Christian tradition, such as the Catholic Thomas Merton, Protestants Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Reinhold Niebuhr, the Orthodox Alexander Yudchaninov, Dmitry Dudko, and Alexander Men, and the Jewish devotee of Christ, Simone Weil, each of whom has been among my own spiritual mentors, can deepen and hone particularly our sense of how better to apply the gospel in our lives. More recent instances, so keenly concerned with the consequences of our own present government's social and moral default, might well include the Benedictine sister Joan Chittister and Rabbi Michael Lerner. Or, as Lowell Bunyan plainly asserted in his classic, once widely used, now long superseded, Investigator and Group Gospel Doctrine Manual, An Introduction to the Gospel, "Latter-day Saints have no monopoly on truth. Latter-day Saints have no monopoly on virtue or righteousness." But have we as a people, particularly in a day when broad and in-depth reading seems such an antique exercise, at all kept pace with the spirit of inquiry we associate with the school of the prophets and the Lord's admonition to understand things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad, the wars and the perplexities of the nations and the judgments which are on the land, and knowledge also of countries and of kingdoms? Were we as a people to read more discerningly, or in many instances read whatsoever concerning ourselves with social issues in the light of fundamental Christian ethics, we would not, I'm persuaded, so monolithically settle for jingoist piety, or be so oblivious to the socially and economically disadvantaged. Surely we would also far better sense that on the broadest societal level, genuine morality and authentic spiritual concern are every bit as applicable and necessary as they are in our private lives. As for the world's heritage of the fine arts and great literature, to what extent do we any more tap into that vast and richly augmenting source of self-insight and perennial wisdom? I have long contended, not so facetiously, that in our courses of study we would do far worse than each fifth year read together as a cautionary manual in courtship and marriage Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. As for our age's most viable and influential medium, I remain indelibly impacted by the sense of sacred, even eternal family ties that emerged in the 1950s. In almost the same year, there appeared the films of Dreyer, Mizoguchi, and Rai, the latter two non-Christian, then later those of the Soviet auteur Tarkovsky. As for our own modest cinematic efforts, nothing strikes me as more refreshingly and wonderfully ecumenical than Richard Dutcher's recent States of Grace. By sensitizing us in their own distinct way, serious art and the humanities afford a moderating hedge, a break, a buffer that keep our devotion from lapsing into fanaticism, our good intentions into smug, even cruel self-righteousness, whether in the Middle East or on the Wasatch Front. Our missionaries' worldwide exposure to a variety of other peoples and cultures has hopefully made some residual difference. After returning from my first mission, I was for several seasons privileged to perform with Salt Lake's Deutsches Theater, which for 30 successive years produced an annual repertoire of both classic German plays and lighter Volksstücke. But our audience was invariably made up of emigre members. Seldom did we see there any returned missionaries, further pursuing their tie with the language or its related culture. With the present day's extremely simplified and heavily prescriptive manuals of instruction, and the trend to assign quotations rather than encourage spontaneous views, even our doctrinal discourse has, I'm afraid, become extremely limited and superficial. Perhaps the new missionary approach, emphasizing personal witness and what is distinctive about one's own conversion, stems from the recognition that greater authenticity and persuasive impact arise from what is, after all, more spontaneous and intimate. We would also, I believe, benefit from emulating the Jewish tradition of more earnest, freewheeling discussion, not to mention more self-confident, self-directed good humor. Meanwhile, while earnestly striving, at least outwardly, to be not of the world, we are in many respects ghetto-like, no longer, especially as individuals, mutual, progressively disposed participants in or a viable part of it, the world. While it is clear that our institutional purpose is mutual edification, which Paul made so eloquently clear in his epistle to the Ephesians, and which is also forcefully reiterated in the Doctrine and Covenants, we only stand to gain, in my view, when allowed to discover saving truths on our own, and not always by didactic dictum. Moreover, credibility increases as we openly admit to ourselves and to others just how fallible, how very like everyone else we deep down really are. Besides our current prophet, I have in this regard found our German apostle, Elder Uchtdorf, a sterling example of such winning personal modesty and self-effacement. While bearing fervent witness, he readily approaches his audience on the same level. Within the fold, there have been and continue to arise other voices that have and do yet strike a common chord and instruct us in, besides strict obedience, heightened spiritual sensitivity. I have mentioned the legendary Lowell Benyon. How many here, could I see by a raise of hands, have had interaction, personal interaction with him or attended his classes? Look at that. Quite a few. For me, there were also Truman Madsen, and more recently, Terrell Givens, not to mention the refreshingly candid, yet well-balanced and tentatively nuanced historian, Richard Bushman. That posture of tentativeness cuts, incidentally, both ways. Do we remember Marden Clark and Marden Sage? Yes, but. Part two. On the other hand, I am frankly saddened whenever another of our leading lights blanketly disavows his or her credence in the historicity of the restored gospel's faith claims. This all too common stance among Mormon intellectuals, many of whom I otherwise admire, strikes me as seriously dismissive of the very first principle upon which all viable religious commitment is necessarily grounded. Struggle as with Paul we all variously do, as we peer through a glass darkly, if we so categorically repudiate as other than truthful fundamental creedal postulates, then how can any of it efficaciously serve us? How, when put to the test, can we possibly respect sacred covenants? Just how inclined are we then to turn to the Spirit for enlightenment and direction beyond our own understanding? Such repudiation of fundamental faith has less to do with either the restored gospel's seeming peculiarities or clueless, abrasive personalities than with a failure to recognize the necessary deference to higher, transcendent insight that attends all genuine reverence and religiosity. As Paul again so forcefully put what I call the epistemology of faith, this time to the Corinthians, and for emphasis, I cite him here at considerable length. For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knoweth no man, but the spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God. Which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. To which Chittister would almost perversely add, to quote her, beware the ability to reason. It enables us to be the only part of nature that behaves unnaturally. We should sooner heed and emulate the appeal voiced by the father of the possessed son to the Savior, Lord, I believe, help thee my unbelief. To which, after healing that man's son, the Lord declared, this kind can come forth by nothing but by prayer and fasting. If in fact, as such New Testament and other spiritual sources consistently imply, our access to such divine intervention and our very understanding of things not seen are anathema to mere reason and to the natural man, then we should feel all the more reassured that, whether by Lou Dobbs, John Krakauer, Larry McMurtry, James Wood, not Woods, Wood, one of our finest contemporary literary critics, British, or by association the producers of HBO's Big Love, the LDS Church is still universally viewed by both those outside it and by its own higher critics as weirdly preposterous, even malevolent, its peculiar theology highly incredible. Or as the Savior himself put it to non-believers, perceive ye not, yet neither understand? Have ye your heart yet hardened? Having eyes, see ye not, and having ears, hear ye not, and do ye not remember? His gospel's seeming opacity, like for many a hearer his parable's unintelligibility, being itself a kind of protection for what is most sacred. The onus, the accountability, being not on him or what he has revealed, but on us. Do we individually enough worry about the possibility of our own deficient faith before finding fault and going on the offensive? Or does such neutrality, such a non-critical stance, strike us as already too much of a catch-22? Perhaps we too cavalierly overlook what, for want of a better term, I call hooks. The experiential hooks that in each of our lifetimes, more commonly, I suspect, than we readily recognize, have in the past stunningly and often unexpectedly amazed and spiritually grabbed us. If hook is a rather crude expression, connoting as it does over-dependency, even addiction, we might further relate it to the metaphorical notion that the Savior himself is the great fisherman and we the fish he rescues from a sea of aimlessness, self-absorption, and ultimate despair. I believe that each of us has encountered such testimony galvanizing hooks, often in particular role models, but that we can, and with time also, all too easily dismiss or forget. The spirit, as we are told, is just that fragile. You know when you know, when it has spoken to you. The trick is not to forget. As I have commented about a number of LDS Russians, I have at one time known to be dynamic and fully engaged disciples and leaders. It is a further witness that in the seemingly alien environment and culture of Russia, there were still those who heard our missionaries' message and at least for a time felt the Spirit so deeply. The genuineness of their conversion was evidenced by their remarkable faith, humility, enthusiasm, and eagerness to serve. Even those who were our branch and district presidents and are no longer with us once manifested those same qualities and clearly felt the Spirit. They have simply forgotten it and not allowed it to continue as a force that pulsates in them and informs their lives. The Spirit is that tenuous. Allow me now to share with you several of my own hooks. It's a rather long list, for which I apologize, but it probably will raise the interest level a little bit, anecdotally. The aforementioned prophet of my youth and young adulthood, David O. McKay. The profound mentoring during my undergraduate years and in an LDS institutional setting by Lowell Bunyan, who equally impacted Jean and Charlotte England, Mary Lithgow Bradford, Douglas Alder, Emma Lou Thane, I suppose Toby Pingree, and ever so many others. The wise tutelage of another remarkable role model and priesthood leader in Provo, Jay Baliff. I wish you all knew Jay. The impulse in my senior year of college to approach my bishop and ask him to call me on my first mission. The unforeseen consequences of that road taken have been manifold and long-lasting. Before that moment, I had, though unwittingly, too exclusively pursued the life of the mind, although I was then the interchapter president of Lambda Delta Sigma at the Institute with 500 members. It was the narrow, almost myopic worldview of my otherwise admirable professors and what at least struck me as the shallowness of many of their lives that in my senior year at last impelled me to opt for something less theoretical and more all-embracing, more existentially challenging and humanly hands-on. I have since come to view Mormonism as the ultimate humanism, concerned as no other philosophy or social system with the long-term welfare of every individual. My own severe crisis of faith, we've heard about Dan's. Well, on that first mission, after arriving in Germany, I soon realized that I still did not know or sense with enough certainty that what I was persuading others to take upon themselves was actually of God, an impasse whose resolution came weeks later and in a form I did not anticipate. Allow me to expand a little on this one. Its immediate cause was, after, on a preparation day and at my urging, my companions and I had attended a French film version of Colette's Gigi. My disappointment at their revulsion, or their pretended revulsion with the plot's particular setting, the training of a young girl by her mother and grandmother to enter the world's oldest profession, albeit eventually thwarted by her insistence that her debonair suitor, played by Charles Boyer in the film version, also become her husband. We had just produced that play at the U of U, and you may recall its general acceptance in the later American film version, also with Leslie Caron. The deeper cause was my realization at the time that I could not in good conscience persuade others to so radically alter their lives, including the forfeiture of 10% of their ongoing income, if I were not more certain that our message and its sponsoring church were in fact distinctively divine. In desperation, I wrote the then apostle who had set me apart, Hugh B. Brown, and the young fellow Lambda Delta Sigma-er, Miriam Dixon, who had already proven such a helpful confidant and friend. Their counsel simply reminded me of those fundamental things we are all asked to do to gain a testimony. I remember to this day, over a half century later, the very moment and exactly where I was sitting in the Hannover Gemeindehaus Melchizedek Priesthood classroom when on an early weekday morning I was studying the language and missionary discussions, and approximately 2 months later, and quite unanticipated, what I can only call an undeniable witness entered my mind and bosom. Prior to that moment, as excessively romantic as this may sound, I had seriously contemplated defecting to France. I'd already studied French at the U of U, but not German. And there, too ashamed to return to family and friends, getting lost in the French Foreign Legion. With what dismal consequences during the subsequent Algerian revolt, I can now only imagine. It was, in fact, an unusually understanding and empathetic missionary assistant to the mission president, designated back then as mission second counselor, who first took me tracting and whom I particularly credit with keeping me aboard during those precarious first weeks. He was an accomplished pianist and aspired to become a surgeon. Instead, I learned a few decades later from his two nephews, who were among our study abroaders in Vienna, that their uncle had ended up a restaurateur in San Francisco, where, never marrying, he contracted AIDS and then returned to his roots in rural Utah, nursed there by a sister until his ultimate demise. For 3 years in the 1970s, while serving at the Provo MTC, I was further privileged to witness in many there and deeply impacted by a spiritual wrestling and subsequent conversion similar to my own in those fledgling missionaries. It was always thrilling to behold and very real, dynamically transforming the quickening, emancipating, nearly palpable source of greater and more genuine childlike humility, caring for others, and profound joy, beautiful and sacred. Before I was called to that position for 3 years, working with some 1,500 in all new missionaries, I pitied my colleagues who were doing that, who were their branch presidents and were from a distance simply processing bodies, as it seemed to me. That was as good as any mission experience. Other instances, to continue my list, of what I still consider miraculous intervention and transcendent insight while on that first mission, including the discernment that enabled me to perceive that as others argued against the church or threatened to leave it, they were invariably, as Dostoevsky's Mishkin puts it, really talking about something else. The further reassuring discovery that having for a time managed to put aside my doubts so that faith could have its way, I was not in the least lobotomized, but still as capable as I am right now of questioning, considering counter-arguments and entertaining various forms of doubt, and perhaps most important, the prompting I had while with 2 more years to serve to propose to my future wife, now both of us just 2 years away from our golden anniversary, a decision that has subsequently proved to be more than inspired. The belated discovery through intensive personal study of Acts and Paul's epistles during that same first mission, that in its organization, lay offices, gifts, ordinances, and their purposes, As well as its proselytizing thrust and communal lifestyle, the pristine Church of Christ and the one I represented were, in contrast to so many others, distinctively one and the same. In all this time, Miriam's steady example of unstinting love, wisdom, sacrifice, and faithfulness. I should have made her come to hear that. She's read it, though. The response in 1970s India of a venerable Sanskrit tutor, Srimati Jipanda, to my query, in your entire pantheon of deities, was there ever anyone who taught love for one's enemies and also voluntarily suffered and died for humankind? No, was her cryptic but carefully considered reply. The spirituality, less articulated than exemplified by various colleagues and peers, the current patriarch for the church in Russia, and recently appointed to head the Jerusalem Center as well, if he ever gets there, Gary Browning, and Don Jarvis, who earlier presided, both of them, over missions in Moscow and Ekaterinburg, and with his wife Janelle, is currently serving a humanitarian aid mission in Belarus, being just two instances of those wonderfully influential colleagues at BYU. In addition to those 3 years at the Provo MTC, multiple epiphanies that have accompanied my approximate 8 years of full-time, often taxing missionary service, including, again, the first-hand observation of astounding and edifying transformations in converts, enduringly faithful members, and above all, fledgling missionaries. Recognition of the great blessing in the lives of our offspring, their spouses, and those of their children who have served missions and remained full participants in the work of the church. Throughout my extended family and over several generations, incidentally, I have witnessed how consistently closer and more mutually supportive such persons are than those who have repudiated that heritage and so much more exclusively live for and focus upon their immediate selves. The heady amalgam of unfettered inquiry and artistic exploration of Mormon roots and culture at BYU that accompanied those almost two golden decades of LDS scholarship spearheaded by Leonard Arrington and his associates, together with the distinctive combination of like-minded loyalty and unfettered openness to inquiry on the part of so many respected colleagues and students there, particularly in the BYU Honors Program and Colleges of Humanities and Family and Social Sciences. Again, the almost palpable spirit of Elijah that increasingly overcomes me with nostalgic affinity for departed forebears, perhaps an appropriate preparation for the day I too must leave this life and can hopefully rejoin them. An increasingly deeper sense that love, not knowledge, is the key to all else, and that both its ultimate source and its object is deity, that without that influence we are further limited in our ability to accept and care for one another. Responding from Belarus to the foregoing list, Don Jarvis wrote the following. I particularly liked your emphasis on memory as a crucial aspect of testimony. The word remember in my Word Cruncher scripture search program produces over 330 verses, including the sacrament prayers and Alma 5:6. When I used to have someone in my BYU ward or MTC branch looking for some miracle to pump up a deflated testimony, I would ask them if they had done what you suggest by recalling personal hooks from their own lives. Many, but admittedly not all, found that very helpful. I certainly do. Alma in chapter 5 talks even more about imagining future events, reminding us that faithfulness is very much an individual activity, end quote. Don's meaning here, I believe, is that maintaining a vital and abiding faith requires ongoing reflection and cognition, a discerning reassessment and sorting out of both our preconceptions and our dissonant ever-competing inclinations by recalling our long-term experience and lessons learned but all too easily forgotten, which may in fact be a fair description of efficacious meditation and prayer. None of us is fully insulated, no one completely sealed off from uncertainty and occasionally nagging doubt, much as we might prefer otherwise. We are all God wrestlers, Rick, as you well know. As with our less than consistently or at all times unambiguously ethical deeds, maintaining faith is all uphill, and its slope sometimes steep. If we think or declare otherwise, as we often do, we are in denial. No one gets through this life free of fault or utterly robotized. We weren't intended to. Among my heroes are those mid-19th century Russians, like Tolstoy, Mussorgsky, and the painter Repin, who so agonized over the plight of the far less favored peasants, tirelessly working in their behalf and yearning to be one with them. Simultaneously, on another continent, a society was emerging with potential for that desired outcome, more beneficial and far-sighted than the socialist phenomenon that so tragically impacted those Russians' descendants. On their very soil, I have witnessed its effects in the lives of a fair number of them. Those effects are not just theoretical. They are very real. Barriers of unfamiliarity, social class, and even nationality disappear. In our interaction, we bask together in mutual affection and supportiveness, truly one another's sisters and brothers. Few religions achieve this. That of the Latter-day Saints can and often does. Or, as Don Jarvis further comments, again from the trenches, while with his wife, Janelle, distributing wheelchairs, arranging for free dental care by stateside volunteers, and staging puppet shows for Belarusian children on personal hygiene. This going to the people is yet another evidence of the Church's efforts to bridge heaven and earth, so unlike the Neoplatonic dualism of much of classical Christianity with its monks' celibacy and retreat from the world it is supposed to serve." End quote. To varying degree, our particular religious heritage and our membership in the Restored Church have involved us all in a great experiment in sociability and mutual assistance. A practical effort to realize once more the humanistic ideal of the family of man, the brotherhood and sisterhood of humankind. Is there elsewhere a more all-encompassing expression of divine purpose than, in its elegant simplicity, like some classic mathematical axiom, the Church's statement of its threefold mission? For all this, we are truly indebted to the vision of the prophet Joseph Smith and the divine influence that worked through him. Am I running out of time fast? Okay, sorry about that, I didn't time this well. Walking that perennial razor's edge between, on the one hand, remaining one's unique individual self, and on the other, subordinating one's will to acknowledged authority and conforming to group expectations, well, that too keeps life from being anything but dull and unchallenging. And I will skip along. I'm moving along here, believing. Part three. I am aware that among us are more than a few whose personal experience with other members and with authority have been less fortunate than my own. I do not presume to judge how fairly or unfairly they've been dealt with. I empathize with the pain and recognize that their pain like this may be one of the few places left to them as a sounding board or where they feel accepted. I'm not sure that in their shoes I would see things any differently. If their experience or that of others they know about has led them down a more skeptical path, how can any of us completely avoid such subjectivity? Then that is between them and their maker. But the possibility that in the process, if largely subconsciously, they have confused what are ultimately accidentals with what is far more fundamental needs to be explored, because what is or was for them at one time fundamental is all important. And then I get into something that recently came to my attention as I read Sunstone. Clearly, the First Presidency's recent strong mandate that members petition lawmakers regarding the definition of marriage is, for many here, a burning case in point. In this regard, I do not presume to second-guess the First Presidency's, or if you will, the Lord's motives. In our time, obviously enough, traditional marriage and with it the stability of family life and the optimum welfare of children are diversely and multiply challenged, as much by fashionable indifference to marital bonding whatsoever as by newly spotlighted fundamentalist polygamy, once our practice, but no longer. The devastating social consequences are everywhere before us. However, it is labeled can and should, as citizens in our greater pluralistic society, consenting adults who opt for same-sex union, be otherwise accorded equal rights and privileges with all others? I think so. Will other citizens and members, while subscribing to that stricter, more traditional definitional construction, charitably enough accord homosexuals those same rights and privileges? We can be sure they will not, at least at present. Here, too, ecumenism is called for of an impersonal kind, though sadly lacking. And then I specifically address that very poignant and moving account by one who is here and presenting again at this symposium, John Donald Gustav Rathall, who wrote A Gay Mormon's Testimony in the April 2006 issue of Sunstone. I was to bring together art, particularly my discipline's great literary tradition and Gustav Rathall's own real-life plight, immediately reminded of Dmitri Karamazov, whom in Dostoevsky's great novel, the institutions of his day accuse of and condemn for our most heinous crime, patricide. The parallels are striking. Until it is discovered that his psychopathic half-brother, Smidyakov, is in fact their father's murderer, Dmitri considers himself the real perpetrator and suffers accordingly. Smidyakov's eventual suicide and another brother Ivan's subsequent dementia stemming from his own subconscious complicity in their suffering. Dmitri's surrogates project the agony Dmitri both publicly and privately undergoes. And then I conclude talking about the saintly abbot of that monastery, Zosima. It is, I believe, safe to understand his profound symbolic gesture as when first meeting Dmitri, he bows low to Dmitri. Nothing is editorialized, just the gesture, as often occurs in Dostoevsky. Have various critics, as the saintly Zosima's intuitive recognition of the inordinate suffering that Dmitri must shortly undergo, suffering that is in view of his innocence, particularly sacred, and which in its way reflects Zosima's own biography and that of Zosima's even saintlier, now deceased, older brother. At this point in time, we all need to bow, as does Zosima, all of us, brothers and sisters, before our John Donald Gustav Rathalls, as I do before particularly my former students and those missionaries I served with whose hormonally destined path was much the same. And I end by citing here Mae Swenson and scooping her brother Paul, who will be discussing her later. Wonderful poem. And he'll have more of that to share with you. But that's also an ecumenical outreach on my part to one who early, I think, in her career departed from the faith. And yet, as I say here, her appreciation for universal love could well be represent the spiritual response to the same on the part of one of our prophets. Sorry, I couldn't read it to you because that's the best part of the paper. Thank you.
Brother Rogers, it's a huge honor, a personal honor and privilege to me to be able to follow you and just to tell you how important what you presented was and how important the portions that I received by email have been to me and what they've meant to me. I feel that you've articulated something that to me, sort of articulated and unified something that to me were a group of unorganized thoughts troubling my mind. It's so refreshing to know that other people have the questions and the struggles and find answers that I can benefit from. I have so much I'd like to respond to, but I'd like to share with you and they can listen. The one thing that really stood out as important to me, and that is of your concept of hooks. You've listed a number of what you call your hooks, those moments of clarity that you perhaps lean on to show you that show you the truthfulness of the gospel. As someone who's been struggling for a few years to find my place in the church, I have myself have my hooks. And I think I've developed a definition of faith that is not a source of knowledge, but instead a hope of understanding it all someday, and perhaps an acknowledgement that I don't have enough data now to make the best conclusion. And in absence of that data, the best thing I have right now are my hooks. I know when I sit in the temple with my wife that everything else dissipates, and that I can sit next to her and hold her hand and know that the gospel is true and know that Jesus Christ is my Savior. All the questions I have, all the doubts I have, all the frustrations I have with sitting through 3 hours of church of largely, as you've mentioned, discussions reduced to quote reading and pre-prepared patterns of thought that are not stimulating, I can still sit in the temple and have that feeling of knowing that the gospel is true. I appreciate what you said today because I feel like it's given me that strength to rely on that hook and for now to use that as my foundation and to hold off the judgment that I have, to hold off on a final judgment, weighing out all the doubts I have and all the good information I have as well. I don't want to take much more time because I'm sure you have questions, but although I, my first instinct there was to say, but that's subjective, so that doesn't count. As someone who's pursuing a degree in science, I feel no, objective only. But it occurred to me as you spoke that so what if it's subjective, because what isn't? The mystery and the magic of human consciousness is that it is subjective. That 1.5 kilograms of brain tissue manages to conceive of the universe and dares to take it personally. That everything, in fact, I'm studying a disease now where someone loses subjectivity and goes insane and thinks that they're dead and are in hell because they have lost their sense of subjectivity. When Crick and Watson discovered the structure of DNA, their observation of it was subjective. It's repeatable and it's observable, but so I've decided are my hooks. Just as I could work hard enough to understand the physics and the chemistry and the photography involved in discovering that structure of DNA, and I myself could repeat that process and have that same subjective observation they had, I'm convinced today that anyone could go through the steps I've gone through to become worthy of the temple once again after a period of not being, to return to the temple and to sit there with their wife and to know the gospel's true. That is subjective to me, but I am convinced today that it's in that sense a repeatable hook that anyone could obtain and rely on. I thank you very much for sharing what you did. I've been personally enriched by it. Thank you.
Rick, all I can say in reply in a nutshell is that yours was a hard act to precede.
We've got 9 minutes for interaction. Please go up to the microphone with your questions or comments. I'd like to get everything on recording.
Okay, you talked about the challenge of working out your personal life and your obedient life, as it were, to the greater collective, and also the idea that you can't possibly get through it being robotized. But as a non-Mormon, from the outside, that's the most common accusation one hears in the prejudicial conversation that dominates our little city. And so how do you account for the, I'm the only non-Mormon member of the board for the Association of Mormon Letters, and I certainly don't, I haven't met the robot yet, I'm waiting. But they can't seem to agree on anything.
You wouldn't meet that robot there.
There's no robot there, no. But I wondered how it is that you are, in your mind, you are perceived from the outside in that way. Why is it that from the outside it's difficult to see this, the human struggle that Mormon people engage, how well they do it, mm-hmm. and how not robotized they are? It doesn't show very well to us out here. How come?
Well, I think we all lead dual lives. I think that struggle is in every one of us. And I'll give you an example. When I was invited to teach Doctrine and Covenants at BYU and took a special summer's orientation for that, for which I was well paid by the College of Religious Instruction, I had the weird feeling as I interfaced with those students that whereas they were curious and inquiring in all of their other classes, when they came into the religion class, they put on a different hat. And they were waiting to be told that which was familiar and safe to hear. I tried to get them to write essays, interpreting in a personal way various items in the Doctrine and Covenants. And I was so disappointed, to be honest, that I refused to teach religion there anymore. And it's too bad. I think we have our Sunday persona and then the other. I used to put on the board for a few students, brazenly, the two things that we worship. One was the dollar sign, and the other was Moroni on the steeple of a temple. And they're not totally reconcilable.
Everyone seems to have a public and a private life, and that's appropriate, I think.
Yeah.
But the accusation from without is that what somehow Mormons are different, and that fear is why in religion class questions won't come up. They wait to hear the right thing. I don't think that that's so, because I suspect you're people like me. I suspect we have something in common as people, and fear could never force me to do that, and I doubt very much it forces you.
I don't think I use the word fear.
No, I'm asking if that is the accusation from the outside.
There's
what is
fear of peer pressure, for one thing.
That's what I was asking, what your explanation was.
Well, you know, dear Leslie Norris, I'm going to cry. He was not LDS. The poet in residence at BYU until his untimely, as far as I'm concerned, death a year ago. One of the finest Christ-like men that ever served on that faculty, whose influence in that respect far extended beyond that of most of the rest of us, said to me once in a private conversation, he was very careful, he needed to be, and he knew that, he was very tactful, but he said, "Yes, the Mormons are a bit smug." I don't have the full answer to that. Yeah.
There's an old Sunstone comic that shows one person speaking at Sunstone on Saturday and then at church the next day. And on Saturday he just says, "Question." And then on Sunday says, "Obey."
You know, I told our Davis County Ward High Priest group that I was giving this paper and that I was going to put it to some of the non-believers who attend Sunstone. And some of those brethren, one a patriarch and others, said, "I want to read that." And they did. And nothing really, as far as I know, untoward came of it. But I was frightened.
Yes.
I was frightened at the time. And maybe I underestimated them. You know, that can happen too. This reminds me of an incident. What were you saying when the incident, the anecdote you just gave us?
Question and obey.
Oh yes, there's a marvelous short Soviet story which I used in my dissertation, among others, and it's about people attending who are working on a collective farm, just bickering and complaining right and left about the way that the norms are unreasonably imposed on them, and you know that they have to put up with all of these regulations. And then all of a sudden they go into a room and they're having a party meeting, and these are the leaders themselves, and their words are totally the opposite. So it's human nature a bit, I guess. Yes.
My name is Ken Rueckert, and I'm from Dallas, Texas. And I was wondering, in your experience at BYU, I read a book one time by Tolstoy called "The Kingdom of God is Within You," and that changed Gandhi from being a radical lawyer to being the pacifist, which changed all of India, in many ways changed the world.
Yeah.
At BYU, do they have a list, or do they recommend other authors like this to read?
They do in the College of Humanities. Yes, when I was involved more fully in the honors program, we had a long reading list that we prepared in consultation with the professors who we worked with. not only in fiction but in other areas, and nobody told us what that should be, and we distributed it.
I'm wondering if we're conditioned just from the time we're in primary to accept, you know, the right answers. In primary, if you come up with something, oh no, the teacher's on that's not
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I'm sure,
you know,
we just resort to that.
And seminary and all through, and I think we just become that way.
Very rudimentary kind of pedagogy. I think we just do.
I told some of my friends that I enjoy coming to Sunstone because it's the only place in my experience, in something related to the church, that you can have an honest and open discussion.
That's right.
And I think it's sad.
I think so.
But I think we're programmed that way from primary all through seminary and so on.
I'll be in trouble for saying this now, but when I was on the faculty advisory council, that's kind of a strange designation for a rubber stamp group. We had the dean of the college religious instruction come, and I had taught a number of Book of Mormon classes up to that point, and I suggested to him that we should not have manuals wherein every verse of that book is explained away by some authority, because that's what the manual was, a very thick one, more or less. I said, I think these students, and I mentioned that here in this paper, will gain greater conviction by discovering these truths on their own. His name was Jeffrey Holland.
Yeah, 1 minute. That had to do with my question. We've done a great job here in defining the problem, and I appreciate that. What do you recommend could be done or should be done to have that kind of freedom in a gospel doctrine class that we have here?
Well, I just don't know. You really have to psych out those you're with and know what would... I don't enjoy saying things that are upsetting to other people. I don't get any kicks out of that. And so I think I do a lot of biting of the tongue instead. And I just think that maybe we can be a kind of a... what's the word I'm looking for? A mellowing influence and stress what is more broad-minded when we get a chance and exemplify that and not be ashamed to do that. But we can certainly have our own opinion, our own thoughts, and I think by not continuing to be associating with those saints, we're defaulting. And I think there are teaching moments that come along in our relationships, maybe not in the classroom so much, when we will and can open up to one another. I mentioned in this paper, for example, that the wonderful challenge to serve, which we all have, if we care to take it, in various mundane ways, whether attending the temple or in other ways, is a medium for our getting closer to one another as we serve together. And then getting down to the level of real life together and not being so concerned about exposing our vulnerabilities, our real humanness. And I think that comes as we do serve together in no better way. And it takes time in personal relationships. And you can't win them all.
Thank you, Tom.